This is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the January 21st edition of the County Chronicle. We'll begin with the first page stories. Arcola City Council, dispersing surplus funds, Henson resigns, by David Porter. The Arcola City Council on Monday night voted to return $381,000 to other taxing districts within the city from surplus tax increment financing, TIF, funds. When the city extended its TIF district lifespans, it agreed to share surplus funds with other taxing bodies, which include the school district, the township, the city, county, and college district, as well as the library district, fire protection district, and museum district. In TIF 1, the city is returning $162,000. The school district is the biggest recipient of the surplus of funds with $85,000. From TIF 6, the city is dispersing $218,000, with the school district receiving $114,000. Alderman Gilberto Moreno and Matt Hansen were absent from the 8-minute meeting. Hansen tendered his resignation, which was accepted by the council. In a letter to the city, Hansen said his reasons for stepping down are personal and in no way reflect negatively on the city of Arcola. Also Monday, the council voted to update its memorandum of understanding with the school district for the Joint City School Resource Officer, SRO, Bill Wagoner. City administrator said the changes were to comply with updated state laws. The resource officer is a city employee, but the school district pays 75% of the cost, up to $60,000. Under the agreement, the SRO cannot issue tickets for municipal code violations that occur on school grounds, during school hours, or while students are on school transportation. The council also approved a letter of understanding between the joint water agency owned by Tuscola and Tuscola and the state for water service to a state-owned rest stop. The state will pay for a water main and water service. The agreement previously was approved by the Tuscola City Council. Milano and Grunlow Engineers, LLC, gave an update on projects within the city. For improvements on Bob King Drive and the Egyptian Trail, the cost is estimated at $1 million. Two state grants are expected to pay $600,000 toward the project, with the remaining $400,000 coming from city funds. Wagoner said the West Side Sewer Project is well underway. They're replacing sewer lines for 3 houses a day on average, he said. We have to field the usual complaints. All in all, it's to be expected. Generally, the public supports the project. Frustrations that we tear up yards, block driveways, and start too early. Most just want to vent. In his written report, Wagoner said he's working with the Stone River Group, which has the bid for the city's electric aggregation rate. He said that last year, Ameren rates were significantly higher than the city's contracted price, but the rates fall rates fell lower. He said the city is trying to close the gap through a community solar provider. The aggregation contract expires in June and will go out for bid in mid-February or March. Also Monday, Mike Gomez was approved to go from part-time to full-time with the city street department. His salary will go up $22 per hour, up from the part-time rate of $17 per hour. A water and sewer committee was also held, but was all in closed session. The next article, Village Grove School Board, discuss sports co-op, teacher speaks out, by Nolan Morse. Conditions for a possible sport co-op that would combine the student bodies of Villa Grove and Heritage were presented on Monday night's Villa Grove School Board meeting. The co-op would see the two schools coming together in both varsity and junior varsity football, as well as football cheer and band. The terms of the agreement are still in discussion for both sides, but the first rough draft was presented by Superintendent Carol Munson. Home games will be hosted in Villa Grove, with discussions of some junior varsity games being played at Heritage. The team will compete under the name Villa Grove Heritage and be overseen by a committee including both district superintendents, principals, and athletic directors. All students who comply with IHSA and local district's eligibility requirements may participate on the team. The head coach will be employed strictly by Villa Grove, while assistant coaches may be employed by either district. Heritage schools will provide their players a shuttle bus for home games and practices, while Villa Grove will provide them with transportation to away games. An annual joint budget will be approved by both districts and will work based on the percentage of students participants from each district at the start of the season. So, for example, if they agree on a $10,000 budget and Heritage makes up 30% of the roster, they'll be responsible for providing $3,000. Process for cheer selection is still ongoing, as Heritage stated they want 25% of the representation on the cheer team, but it was proposed at the school board meeting that instead they take the top 20 out of tryouts instead. These terms, which are all subject to change, would take effect during the 2026-2027 school year and be up for renewal after the 2027-2028 school year. High school math teacher Brian Murawski presented an emotional speech regarding teachers receiving public criticism. Murawski stated teachers are being ostracized online for holding students accountable for learning. Yourofsky said teachers were facing harsh backlash online for upholding policy-enforcing grading standards, saying there have been multiple attacks from parents online due to their children receiving a bad grade and blaming the teacher as a result. Warning about the dangers this may cause, Murawski predicted this may lead to teachers handing out arbitrary A's, which would erode student accountability and undermine them for their life beyond high school. He also emphasized how harmful this was to teachers who are not able to publicly defend themselves from these attacks due to Illinois privacy laws protecting student information. Murawski urged the board to hold accountability for fair, accurate grading and to stand behind the teachers. Complimenting and commenting on the speech, school board president Jim Clark stated he believed everyone on the board agreed with the sentiment of protecting teachers, but also stated they cannot control what's on social media. Contractors for renovating the high school bathrooms have been narrowed down to two. It was stated the school has received virtually the same offer from both as board deliberated on which to choose. The school received a state grant which will match funds up to $50,000, and the school expects to pay out of $125,000 out of pocket. No final decision was made. The next article, Arcola School Board, Perfect State Audit, Volleyball Coach Resigns, by Nolan Morse. Arcola Community Unit District earned a perfect 4 out of 4 rating on its annual state audit, while the school board also accepted the resignation of longtime high school volleyball coach Lauren Hamilton during its Wednesday night meeting. Auditor Russ Lee presented what he described as a very clean audit with no issues, noting the district finished the 2025 fiscal year in strong financial conditions. According to Lee, Arcola reduced total expenses by approximately $400,000 compared to the previous year, lowering expenditures from $8.5 million in fiscal year 2024 to $8.1 million in 2025. The district's cost per pupil also declined slightly from $15,780 to $15,770. Lee said the decrease was usual, as many comparable schools district have seen significant increases in per-student costs. Arcola ended the fiscal year with revenues exceeding expenses by $568,000, earning the district placement on the Illinois Board of Education recognition list. Looking ahead, Lee warned the state of Illinois could face a projected $1.5 million shortfall tied to the obligations in the teachers' retirement system and the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund. The shortfalls are expected to affect districts statewide. Lee said the state may allow local taxing bodies to help cover the deficit, but added that Arcola's strong financial position should limit the impact on the district. Elementary school principal Marissa Brewer told the board that a small group of representatives will visit two school districts as part of their search for a new elementary English curriculum to be implemented in the 2026-2027 school year. The options have been married to two programs with a presentation scheduled for February outlining the strengths and weaknesses of each. The board also discussed plans to create a kindergarten pullout class aimed at nonverbal and developmentally challenged students. The class would provide targeted instruction focused on vocabulary development and speech skills. In other business, the board accepted the resignation of Lauren Hamilton, who has served as Arcola High School's volleyball coach since 2020. Board members discussed posting the coaching vacancy. The board also approved a proposed 2027 student trip to Walt Disney World. The next article, Judge Delays Nickerson Trial, by Nolan Morse. Judge Kate Wilson granted the state a 120-day extension in the case against Taji Nickerson, citing the state's inability to obtain DNA evidence this far. The motion was filed by state's attorney Robert Kosick, who said the prosecutors have not yet collected any DNA evidence linked to Nickerson. In granting the request, Watson said the state still has a reasonable probability of obtaining DNA evidence that would be vital to the case. Nickerson is charged with attempted murder, a Class X felony, in connection with the double stabbing of Matthew Wilkin and Amanda Lampkin on November 29th. The case is currently set for trial March 9th, but will be delayed as long as July 25th under the extension. And the last first-page story, World War II MIA ID'd. Defense Department identifies remains of soldier as Douglas County's Paul Gregg. Staff Sergeant Paul A. Dusty Gregg of Douglas County, Illinois, has been classified as missing in action, MIA, since 1944 after hostile actions during World War II. He is MIA no longer. On January 15th of this year, the Defense Department POW MIA Accounting Agency, the DPAA, declared Gregg accounted for earlier last year. Known only as X-114 before identification, Gregg is rested in an American cemetery site in Belgium until his recent disinterment. A funeral in Arcola is pending. Gregg lived throughout Douglas County area, born in Arcola in 1915, lived in Garrett, played high school football captain and star of the team in the early to mid-1930s for Atwood, and worked for various cafes and restaurants in Arthur before being drafted into the Army in 1941. In September 1943, Gregg was deployed overseas for combat. In 1944, as part of the 28th Infantry Division, he found himself in fierce fighting near Furin, Luxembourg during the Battle of the Bulge. According to a letter sent from Captain M. O'Day to Miss Ada Fern Dixon of Arthur in September 1945, Staff Sergeant Gregg was captured in the Ardennes breakthrough while in charge of his section when marched to the rear of an artillery barrage laid down in error by the Germans themselves, fell right in the middle of the column of marching prisoners. According to the report of a soldier captured at the same time but later freed, Sergeant Gregg was killed in this barrage. Not all bodies were recovered from the tragedy and were identifiable. According to this one particular body found, now identified as Gregg, was simply labeled as X-114. Gregg was soon added to the U.S. total's World War II death toll of around 400,000 soldiers, of which approximately 79,000 were classified as MIA. Today, the MIA figure is down to approximately 73,000, thanks to the dedicated nonstop work of DPAA and various military museums and historical agencies that continue to this day the complicated mission of locating, identifying, and reuniting soldiers with grieving family members. According to its press release, the DPAA is a Department of Defense agency whose mission is to recover and identify service members listed as prisoners of war or missing in action from past conflicts. Officials said that in 2021, a DPAA historian completed a study of unresolved combat losses in Furin from the Battle of the Bulge and recommended that X-114 remains be disinterred for scientific comparison to Gregg. Following exhumation of the remains in 2024, they were confirmed to be Gregg's through dental, anthropological, and DNA analysis. X-14 was confirmed to be Gregg. The Armory itself also did everything it could to help families of MIA soldiers during my term of service during the early Vietnam Wars in the early 70s. Part of my duties as commander of the Armed Forces facility included personally meeting monthly at the homes of parents and their spouses in my area of central Massachusetts. We discussed the status of their missing loved one and the actions being taken to identify and reunite the parties. As you might imagine, there were seldom, sadly, any new facts. Over 50 years later, I still remember those visits. The people were always gracious, understanding, and had largely accepted the fact of death, and yet always detected this glimmer of hope in them. Perhaps some injury that led to amnesia, perhaps captured and not reported by the enemy. Perhaps. This is the pain of a loved one upon hearing MIA. A reported death is usually quite traumatic to hear, but unlike an MIA certification, grieving often occurs instantly and can usually lead to eventual closure. But there was a sense I had while visiting MIA families that grieving and closures could not occur until the person is found and returned to his family to rest peacefully, reunited with loved ones in a familiar setting, being the home from which they were dispatched on short notice. Displaced into strange and dangerous places, charged with harsh task. May the Gregg family finally have closure, peace, and spirit-filling pride in the reassuring proclamation of Jesus telling his disciples that the greatest love is sacrificial. Greater love has no one than he lay down his life for one's friends. That article was by Mike Carroll. We'll move now to the obituaries. Rosa Yoder. Visitation will be held on Friday, January 23rd from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. at Pleasant View Church, Arcola. Funeral services and burial will be held on Saturday, January 24th at 10 a.m. at Pleasant View Church. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. Loretta Hart, 85, of Arcola, passed away at 12:03 p.m. on Thursday, January 15th at her residence. Family graveside services will take place in the Moores Cemetery in Gilbertsville, Kentucky, on a later date. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting the family. Clara J. Schrock, 91, of Arthur, passed away at 2:08 a.m. on Monday, January 19, 2026, at her residence. Funeral services will be held at 9 a.m. on Thursday, January 22nd, at the HCK West Building, 1 mile south of Arthur. Bishop Melvin Kaufman will officiate. Burial will be in the Yoder Cemetery in rural Arthur. Visitation will be held any time after 1 p.m. on Tuesday, January 20th, and any time after 10 a.m. on Wednesday, January 21st, all at the HCK West Building. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. Dr. Ricardo Izquierdo passed away into God's hands on January 13, 2026. Rick was born in Havana, Cuba on September 23, 1995, to Dr. Ricardo Jorge Izquierdo Serra and Mercedes de Solo Florida de Izquierda. Funeral services will be private. A celebration of his life will be held in early summer. Marquita Ann Skeets Mulrooney, 86, of Decatur, formerly of Arcola, passed away at 12:25 p.m. on Saturday, January 10, 2026, at her residence. Funeral services will be held at 4 p.m. on Wednesday, January 21st, at the Edwards Funeral Home, 221 East Main Street, Arcola. Chaplain Joe Bowman will officiate. Visitation will be held 2 hours prior to the funeral from 2 to 4 p.m. at the funeral home. Gaylene Kidwell, 79, of Bethany, passed away at 3:44 p.m. Wednesday, January 14, 2026, at her home. Funeral services were held Monday, January 19th at the McMullen Young Funeral Home, Bethany. Visitation was held prior to the service, Monday at the funeral home. Burial will be held at a later date in Todd's Point Cemetery, Findlay. Memorials may be made to the donor's choice. The next article, top Democrats said they would consider small changes to Illinois' Safety Act. Cook County Chief judge to issue report that could guide new legislation. Some of Illinois' top Democrats say they're open to considering targeted changes to Illinois' controversial Safety Act this spring if a forthcoming judicial report says they're needed. Both Governor J.B. Pritzker and House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch, Democrat of Hillside, say the changes, if ultimately deemed necessary, would be narrow, despite Republicans' desire to see the law drastically overhauled. Welch said he's awaiting a report on the law that is still being crafted by Cook County's top judge. State lawmakers passed the Safety Act in January 2021 as a part of a series of initiatives led by the Legislative Black Caucus in response to civil unrest and racial justice conversations after the 2020 murder of George Floyd. The most controversial part of the law is the Pretrial Fairness Act, which eliminates cash bail. Welch and Pritzker noted it is routine for state lawmakers to review and tweak any law on the books. The sweeping criminal justice reform law passed in 2021 and has already been subject to multiple amendments. After a couple of years of data, you know, sometimes you do trailer legislation, Welch told Capital News, Illinois. Is this the time to do that? It may be, but there may not be anything to do at all. Elimination of cash bail. The Pretrial Fairness Act takes wealth out of the equation as judges determine whether an individual charged with a crime is incarcerated while awaiting trial. While officers are directed to cite and release low-level, nonviolent offenders rather than arrest them, violent or more serious crimes can still end in arrest and potential detention pending trial. The new system allows states' attorneys to petition for pretrial detention, and judges can determine whether to grant it based on the offender's risk of reoffending or fleeing prosecution. The law also instructs courts to take the least restrictive means of ensuring a person's appearance in court, meaning nonviolent offenders often end up in electronic monitoring as opposed to awaiting trial from jail cell. Proponents note the crime is down since the Safety Act's implementation, as is the state's jail population. I think the Safety Act is working, says Senator L.G. Sims, a Chicago Democrat who led the law through the Senate, told Capital News Illinois. Is it perfect? No, no law is ever perfect. But again, I think we've got data that shows that the communities are more safe because of the Safety Act in place. An October report by the Loyola University Center of Criminal Justice found monthly pretrial jail populations had fallen 7% statewide since the PFA went into effect, but pretrial supervision populations had risen 33% during the same period. In Cook County, jail populations had increased by about 2% despite an initial drop after the PFA became law. Total statewide population of people awaiting trial on either electronic monitoring or in jail has actually grown 17% since the law took place, according to the October data. Opponents of the law during its passage had called on lawmakers to grant judges greater discretion and to limit the number of circumstances where law prohibits them from ordering detention. Since the law's implementation, its harshest critics have frequently pointed to instances of individuals who reoffend, often in cases where a judge has declined a prosecutor's request for pretrial detention. One recent event that's put renewed scrutiny on the law involves 26-year-old Bethany McGee, who was lit on fire in an L train in Chicago in November. Prosecutors said Lawrence Reed, the man charged with terrorism and arson in the connection with the case, has been arrested 72 times over the last 30 years. Block Club Chicago reported he's been convicted 15 times, including for arson in 2020 after lighting a fire outside the Thompson Center, the former state office building in Chicago. At the time of the alleged attack on McGee, Reed was out on electronic monitoring. State's attorneys had sought his detention in August as a threat to public safety after he allegedly physically assaulted a nurse in Berwyn Hospital. WGN reported the Illinois County judge denied prosecutors' request despite the evidence. Illinois law requires individuals on electronic monitoring to wear ankle monitors, but entitles them to 2 days of free movement or about 2 8-hour periods per week. Some have blamed the Safety Act for Reed's L train crime. Some argued the state shows why the state needs to keep investigating more mental health resources. The state's Democratic leaders don't go into specifics about what changes, if any, they're currently considering. I think everything is open to listening to what changes might be made, Pritzker said at a November news conference following the L incident. But like Welch, Pritzker added that changing laws is a routine part of the legislative process. The General Assembly has also amended parts of the Safety Act since it was first passed, particularly as it pertained to offenses that are non-detainable. before the Grand Assembly makes any changes. Weld said he wants to see a report from Cook County Judge Charles Beach's office that is on track to be released in the end of January. If the chief judge comes to me and has some ideas, I've told him I'm going to be all ears because our goal is always to make things better, Welch said. Welch added, it's possible that changes don't have to come from the General Assembly and can be made administratively by the courts. Welch also said he plans to have his public safety working group, a select group of House Democrats, to discuss issues behind closed doors, consider possible changes to the law. Sims said he also has not identified any specific changes. I'm always open to anything that's going to improve public safety and make people in our communities more safe and make sure our criminal legal system is more just, Sims said. GOP proposals. Republicans have more specific ideas about how the safety law should be amended. House Republican leader Toni McCombie, Republican of Savannah, acknowledged in a recent interview with Capital News Illinois that her party's minority status in Springfield means her caucus's focus has to be on making changes to improve the law rather than gutting it altogether, many Republicans have called for. We have quite a few fixes we hope will be embraced, she said. I think to say, you know what, let's support the repeal of the Safety Act. We know that ship has sailed. Let's just put the fixes in that can make this a workable policy. Ideas proposed by Republicans include making all felonies eligible for detention rather than violent felonies, allowing a person's pretrial release to be revoked if they commit any new crime while released, eliminating language that allows people on pretrial home confinement free movement, that a person could be detained when they are charged with a crime against a minor. You saw a lot of that language with the Safety Act, with very broad language, which leaves too much to interpretation, McCombie said. The next article, new dietary guidelines issued by Tammy Sloop. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins on January 7th released the Dietary Guidelines for Americans 2025 through 2030, marking the most significant reset of federal nutrition policy in decades, according to a news release from the secretaries. The top line message reads, "Eat real food. To make America healthy again, we must return to the basics. American households must prioritize diets that build on whole, nutrient-dense foods, protein, dairy, vegetables, fruits, healthy fats, and whole grains. Paired with a dramatic reduction in highly processed foods laden with refined carbohydrates, added sugars, excess sodium, unhealthy fats, and chemical additives, this approach can change the health trajectory for so many Americans," according to a message from the secretaries of realfood.gov. The guidelines reestablish food, not pharmaceuticals, as the foundation of health and reclaim the food pyramid as a tool for nourishment and education, the news release states. The dietary guidelines are the foundation to dozens of federal feeding programs, and today marks the first step in making sure school meals, military and veteran meals, and other children and adult nutrition programs promote affordable, whole, healthy, nutrient-dense food, the White House fact sheet stated. The guidelines emphasize simple, flexible guidance rooted in modern nutritional science and concluded, prioritize protein at every meal. Previous recommendation called for 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. The new recommendation is for 1.2 to 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram. Consume full-fat dairy with no added sugars. Dairy goal is 3 servings per day as part of a 2,000-calorie dietary pattern. Eat vegetables and fruits throughout the day, focusing on whole forms. Incorporate healthy fats from whole foods such as meats, seafood, eggs, nuts, seeds, olives, and avocados. Focus on whole grains while sharply reducing refined carbohydrates. Limit highly processed foods, added sugars, and artificial additives. Eat the right amount for you based on age, sex, size, and activity level. Choose water and unsweetened beverages to support hydration. Limit alcohol consumption for better overall health. Meat and dairy groups praise the new guidelines, while the American Soybean Association released a statement noting its concern the report calls into question the process of soybean oil extraction. Soybean oil and soy protein play a crucial role in the health and nutrition of Americans. U.S. soybean farmers are proud to grow a heart-healthy, high-protein crop that can feed the country and the world, said ASA President and Ohio farmer Scott Metzger. ASC appreciates the 2025 to 2030 guidelines for Americans acknowledge the importance of soy as part of a well-balanced diet, but we remain deeply concerned by the rhetoric and selectively cited studies regarding the health and safety of soybean oil in dietary guidelines supporting material. The guidelines are a whole food framework intended to be customized to individuals and families and their needs, preferences, and financial status. We are restoring common sense, scientific integrity, and accountability to federal food and health policies, and we're reclaiming the food pyramid and returning to its true purpose of educating and nourishing all Americans, the secretary said. These guidelines call on every American to eat more real food. They call on farmers, ranchers, healthcare professionals, insurers, educators, community leaders, industry, and lawmakers across all levels of government to join in this critical effort. Together, we can shift our food system away from chronic disease and toward nutrient density, nourishment, resilience, and long-term health. Next article, farmers hoping for more rain before spring, Douglas County Agriculture by Larry Davis. It remains very dry in Douglas County and the surrounding area midway through January. There was field work done earlier this month with some chisel plowing and nitrogen application. It rained nearly 1 inch on January 9th. That and the following cold weather has stopped field work. The rain put a little water in the small streams, but the field tile are not running. We need more rain before spring. The farming community got a surprise with the Department of Agriculture crop report on January 12th. After the growing season we had, most observers thought there would be a reduction in the corn yield. Instead, the USDA raised both yield per acre and acres harvested. They now call for a U.S. corn crop of 17 billion bushels. Both corn and soybeans lost the hard gains they'd made over the last month. Corn lost 25 cents in the rest of the trading day and a couple more cents the next. The soybean numbers were not as bearish, but they too lost several cents of value. Prospects for another record soybean crop from South America weighed on that community's prices. The rest of the week was filled with news stories about how the USDA produced those yield numbers. Many do not believe the government, but those are the numbers the grade trade will use. The general thought is that farmers will be reluctant to sell grain at these prices. The need to buy inputs and to pay taxes on March 1st will force some sales to be made. We're told the government bridge payment will come in February, but the rules are still being written. The price action of January 12th pretty well ate the money up. The loss in an acre of corn that made 250 bushels exceeded the projected government payment on that acre. Both political parties are floating the idea of further payments to farmers totaling another $15 to $17 billion. This would be included in the continuing resolution that should be passed at the end of January. That does not leave much time to figure it out. This would appear to be an election year pandering, although to a small segment of the country. Agriculture interests have been calling for nationwide 15% ethanol usage in gasoline. This would be another 2 billion bushels of corn on top of the 4.4 to 5 billion used already and give us more income from the market instead of government payments. Soybean interests are hoping for more use of soy oil and jet fuel to raise the price of that commodity. Cotton and rice farmers in the South are facing tough times too. Cotton prices are below the cost of production. I have read of $300 an acre loss on cotton. With a pair of Levi's at $50, someone must be making money. I have a reprint of the first issue of Newsweek magazine in 1939. The cover story is about how low farmer income. This is not a new problem. Cotton is expensive to grow. It requires a lot of fertilizer and pest controls. Cotton pickers are more expensive than combines and will only do one thing. The cotton requires ginning to separate the seed from the fiber. If you sell your cotton picker and the local gin closes, it's unlikely that cotton production will start back up on that farm or in that area. The cost is too large. The federal government came out with new dietary recommendations since my last column. This fits in with my discussion about processed foods. The new food pyramid stresses high-quality proteins and de-emphasizes grains and fiber. Highly processed foods are discouraged as well. Fruits and vegetables remain important to a healthy diet. I don't know how much attention is paid to the federal guidelines. I read in researching that the school lunch programs adhere closely to them. This alone is a multi-billion-dollar market. I also do not know how quickly changes might be instituted. Dairy farmers are pushing whole milk to me again to be included in school lunches. It was for some reason forbidden in the Obama years. Dairy interests think whole milk is valuable for growing children, and being forced to drink skim milk puts them off milk totally. I wouldn't agree with that because I won't drink skim milk. Butter and even lard are back in vogue in food preparation. These saturated fats are more once again seen as healthy. There is starting to be a bias against seed oils and advertising. You're familiar with the wide variety of these oils, including corn oil, canola oil, and soybean oil, usually just called vegetable oil in the store. These are highly processed, to be sure. They do have good nutritional profiles and are shelf-stable. That means that bottles of salad dressing in your cabinet's refrigerator do not go rancid. Seed-derived oils can be a useful part of the diet. That is all we have time for this week. This is Chris Yerking. Say goodbye and see you again next week.